Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Canada routinely faces criticism that we do not meet our spending commitments as a NATO ally. And recently, the Department of National Defense's own internal reporting painted an alarming picture of the state of the Canadian Armed Forces. And recent polling shows that Canadians increasingly worry about what this all means for the country's presence on the world stage. For more on how to navigate these difficult waters, we're joined in North Toronto by Carrie Buck. She is former Canadian ambassador to NATO, now a senior fellow at the University of Ottawa. And here in our studio, Guy Thibault, a retired lieutenant general in the Canadian Army, a former vice chief of the defense staff who's currently chair of the board at CDA Institute. And Christian Leuprecht, professor at Royal Military College and Queen's University, editor-in-chief of the Canadian Military Journal, whose latest book is called Security Cooperation Governance, the Canada-United States Open Border Paradox. And we are delighted to have you two here in our studio. You came from Ottawa. You came from Kingston, a long way to be with us. And Carrie Buck would have been with us here in the studio as well. But I don't know. Should we tell the folks, Carrie, you got a broken leg right now?
Yeah, I've got a broken leg right now.
You got a broken leg. So you're in a cast and you're sort of stuck where you are. But we're grateful you could join us via whatever platform it is you're joining us by. Let's put some of the dirty details on the record here. This is according to an internal report by DND. And Sheldon, bring the graphic up. I'll read along for those listening on podcast. Only 58% of the Canadian Armed Forces would be able to respond if called upon by NATO allies right now. 58%. 45% of the Canadian military's equipment set aside for the defense of Europe faces quote-unquote challenges and is considered, quote, unavailable and unserviceable, 45%. At the end of last year, the document says, the military was short almost 16,000 members, a figure encompassing both regular and reserve elements. Our Minister of National Defense is Bill Blair. Those of us in Toronto may remember he was the former chief of police here. And here's what he had to say about our chronically understaffed military.
If what you are have been doing for decades is no longer working for you, you can't just keep doing it. And over the past 3 years, more people have left than have entered. That is frankly, it's a death spiral for the Canadian Armed Forces. We cannot afford to continue on that pace. We've got to do something differently.
Mr. Thibault, death spiral is pretty heavy rhetoric. You agree with that?
Well, I think it's great that the minister is being this transparent about what he's seen in terms of the challenges for the Canadian Forces. And so the way that he's kind of characterized, if on the people side, if we have more people leaving and we don't have people coming in, that's obviously not a situation that can be tolerated. So I think he's saying we could be in a death spiral unless we actually address these issues of both retaining people and attracting new talent to the forces.
Christian, what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, some of this is self-made and some of this is externally imposed. So I think there's multiple challenges. One is the aging equipment and the strain that imposes on the resources available. So take, for instance, a frigate that 10 years ago would have taken 100,000 person hours to ready to deploy now takes 1.5 million person hours. So ever more money gets consumed simply keeping the aging equipment going. Then you have the significant personnel challenges that by the time you also factor out people who are not deployable for various reasons, you're starting with about 25% down on the staff available to you. But then the government has compounded that by imposing considerable restrictions on contracting. So you could compensate on the personnel side or even on the equipment side with contracting. That is now very difficult as a result of sort of the environment that the political environment that the government has to operate in. And you add to that the spending reductions, so that $1 billion this coming fiscal year and then another $1 billion for the two following fiscal years that had already been budgeted essentially to go to maintaining equipment. So now that means the Canadian Armed Forces have to draw on other areas simply to keep the equipment going. And so this is part of the challenge, that we had a defense policy statement in 2017 that backloaded the spending really into the last 3 years and significant spending into the last 2 years. And that is precisely what the government is now drawing back, which now aggravates an already very severe fiscal and personnel situation.
Let me draw upon your four plus decades, right, in the Canadian Forces and ask you whether Air Force, Navy, Army, are they all equally in dire straits right now?
Well, each of the services have different challenges. And, you know, when you kind of look at it, there's been a lot of announcements recently for the Royal Canadian Air Force in terms of new platforms, which is really welcome. But before those new aircraft come on board, we have to sustain the existing fleets. And so they have that challenge of making that transition between the old and the new. The Navy is also, you know, got a number of great future capabilities on the horizon. So it's a very positive, optimistic look for the Navy in the future, but we got to get there. And in the meantime, there's very significant challenges with the submarine fleet, which keeping them operational. These are boats that were bought from the United Kingdom. It seemed like a really good deal at the time, but when you're buying a bit of an orphan and you're trying to sustain it, it makes it for a very expensive proposition. And the Army, of course, is people-centric, and if the central problems for the Canadian Forces are about people, the Army is the one that suffers the most from it. So each of the challenges in the services are quite different. The missions that we ask of them are different, and so when it comes to readiness, each of their particular issues are different in kind from the other service.
Ambassador Buck, I'm going to give you first crack at responding to a comment that I'm going to read here. This is from the United States Ambassador to NATO, Julianne Smith, who really did not mince words recently when she talked about the percentage of our GDP in Canada that we are contributing to NATO. And here's what she said. Canada is hovering now just above 1.3% and has no concrete plan to get to that 2%, which is the target, while other allies have made and created plans to get there, if not this year, in the next few years. Those timelines and those plans are important because it showcases a shared commitment and it showcases intent. Here, inside the NATO alliance, and certainly back in Washington, we very much encourage our friends in Canada to develop some sort of concrete plan to meet that 2% pledge. That's Julianne Smith, U.S. Ambassador to NATO. All right, what do you believe is holding us back, Ambassador Buck, from putting a plan forward that gets us to 2%?
Well, I think it's because we think we don't need to do it. And we think we don't need to do it because of a very long history and because of our geography. So our geography, we don't see direct security threats to our own territory, airspace, maritime space. We haven't traditionally seen direct threats to those spaces. But also our history, because we've relied on the U.S. as a security protector, an involuntary service provider to Canada since we became a country, essentially. And that reliance on the U.S. has deepened. So we think we don't have to do it. But the problem is that the world has shifted radically. So those stats you showed at the beginning, those are stats that are measured against NATO requirements. And the NATO requirements for readiness have been, Jens Stoltenberg said that this is the largest, most demanding ask of allies that NATO's made since the end of the Cold War. So because of Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, the requirements on NATO allies to have troops not just forward stationed along NATO borders that are close to Russia to send a deterrent message, but also troops that are ready to move in pretty quick order, not just troops, but, you know, Air Force, Navy, Army as well. Those requirements of individual allies have really gone up. So the gap between what we're ready to do because of decades of underinvestment in our military, because we think we're safe, we think we're protected, island Canada, coupled with a worsening security situation where the demands are higher on us, mean that gap is really high between the NATO spending targets and what Canada is spending on the military right now. So the pressure is going to be a lot worse than it has been. That quote you read from the U.S. ambassador to NATO was not a surprise. The U.S. has been saying this quietly and publicly over the years since those NATO spending targets were set. So it's been quite some time, but the gap is really wide right now.
Do you think, Christian, that our fellow NATO allies see us as shirkers?
Well, so look, I think they look at the trajectory that Canada has been on, where the gap continues to grow in terms of what our allies are prepared to spend. And you can see it not in that, just in the overall spending, right? So there's a commitment of 20% spending on equipment and research and development, and Canada is at under 15%. And so relative to other spending, the delta continues to grow. What that means is that you're effectively reducing Canada's voice within NATO, which ultimately has always been the single most important multilateral organization.
Is that true? Like money equals voice? Is it that simple?
There's certainly, so capabilities, commitments, and cash. So that's the three C's. And Canada has long, for a good 2.5 decades, said, don't worry about the cash. We've got the capabilities and we're making the commitments. And we can see, if you just look at recent months, where Canada is not able to make commitments because it no longer has the capabilities to make those commitments. Why doesn't it have those? Because it can't contribute the cash to the overall enterprise. And so ultimately, it means that Canada is reducing itself to not just drafting behind allies, but the inability to steer where that is going. And I would say that in an increasingly volatile security environment, and if we look at the last 25 years, you know, we can leave international security up to the Americans, but I would say let's look at how that's worked out and whether we actually want to take the sort of initiative we showed after World War II in terms of shaping a world that is in both ours and allied interests.
There are going to be people watching us or listening to us right now who are going to say, look, I mean, why should we spend all this extra money when we've got challenges here at home, when we know the Americans are basically our defense policy in a major way right now? What's the argument you would make to those folks?
Well, I think the Canadian Forces, if it's investment in defense and investment in the Canadian Forces, first of all, you're investing in a multi-purpose tool that ultimately serves a number of purposes. And we've seen that the government of Canada keeps turning to the Canadian Forces time and again, whether it be for fighting forest fires, whether it be going into long-term healthcare facilities right. to help out in a pandemic or to respond to floods and fires, humanitarian assistance, disaster
or
relief.
Or blizzards in Toronto.
Blizzards in Toronto, search and rescue every day. There's 9,000 search and rescue events happening every year in our country. So you end up investing in capabilities for Canada to have when the chips are down. And when we look at the international security situation, whether it be Canada's far north and the opening up of the Arctic, whether it be what's going on in Asia Pacific, it's investing in insurance for Canada that we have capabilities to respond when the need arises.
So Ambassador Buck, put us in the room, if you would, when your American counterparts, or frankly from other members of NATO, would come to you and say, you know, it's really not a good look that you guys are always at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to pitching a percentage of your GDP towards NATO. Can you do anything about that? How do you respond?
Say that Canada has contributed to every single NATO mission from NATO's beginning, in one way or the other, participated in one way or the other, that we have some pretty significant and capable military deployments that are core to the alliance. I'd cite here the command of the battle group in Latvia that we took on when I was ambassador in the room, command of the first Iraq training mission as part of the NATO training mission as part of the counter-Daesh coalition, et cetera. So we've got some pretty credible contributions. The second thing I'd say is that the 2% metric isn't really about military effectiveness, and that it's more important to look at what we do with our troops, what we do with our military assets, and some of the political assets that we bring to bear at NATO. All that's good, but the problem is with those recent NATO statistics on spending, which shows that we are the only ally in that quadrant of shame where we don't meet either the 2% of GDP spent on defense nor the 20% of defense dollars spent on procurement-related research and development. We're the only ally sitting out there. It gets increasingly harder to make that argument. Yes, we still have credible contributions. But if, for instance, we can't plus up, like build up the battle group in Latvia to the size that NATO leaders decided we were all supposed to do, if we can't do that quickly enough, you know, it's a situation where we've got the will and the commitment to contribute, but we just don't have the people and the equipment that, you know, allows us to make good on our promises. And that's where the political hit starts to be felt, our reputational hit starts to be felt.
I'm going to ask you a fast Oprah-like follow-up. It sounds like you're saying in your heart, you know they're right. Yes?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, there we go. Asked and answered. Very good. Let's do the next question here. A poll conducted by Angus Reid earlier this month showed that 29% of Canadians have listed military preparedness and the country's presence on the world stage as their top priorities, 29%, which may not sound like a big number, except when you compare it to a decade ago, it was 12%. So a lot more people think it is more significant that we are apparently not playing the role that we ought to be playing in the world today. General, what do you think the what do you think explains that big jump?
Well, I think if Canadians are watching what's going on in the world, whether it be in Ukraine with Russia, whether it be belligerent China, whether it be really an out-of-control North Korea, Iran's interference in a number of parts of the world, like what's going on in the Gaza Strip today, it's not surprising, perhaps, that Canadians are feeling that insecurity that comes from watching the world that we're in. And we have our own challenges here at home that we've seen as a result of climate-related impacts, issues that are in everyday life of the cyber reality, the critical infrastructure. So I think that it's actually important that Canadians sort of are reflecting on the world and are actually contributing to the conversations about, well, what we should be doing in light of all of these changes. So I think it's good to see these kind of changes. I think that the messages that are coming largely out of the national security defense community have been recognizing these changes for some time, but the Canadian public, for what Ambassador Buck already mentioned, we live in a very privileged country, but we're not isolated and we're not immune from these challenges. So I would hope that all of the concerns of Canadians gets translated into kind of conversations at the political level in this country. We actually need to kind of have a consensus built between the political parties about what Canada's role is, what we need to do to contribute to global collective security, to our alliance, to live up to the expectations our partners have of us. And, you know, I think that the defense policy update, which this government has promised 2 years ago, should be that opportunity for them to signal, this is what we are going to do in response to these concerns. So we're still waiting. It's a bit disappointing, to be honest, that we haven't had that that clear direction yet from the government, because it sends a signal to the members of the forces themselves that this is what we're going to do. It sends a message to our allies, the United States and our partners. It also sends a message to adversaries of our commitment to global peace and security.
I like where you went in the middle of that answer, because you asked a really profound question that maybe we don't spend enough time on. And Christian, I'll get you to speak to it first. Do we have a consensus in this country about what we want our Canadian Armed Forces to be or to do?
Look, I think that's a great question. And that's what a lot of, I think, this debate comes down to, not just in Canada, but I would say among most allies, with perhaps the exception of the United States. Is the purpose of the Canadian Armed Forces to provide regional and international security and stability? Is the purpose to secure open trade routes, freedom of navigation type missions? Or is the purpose to do human security type operations?
What do you think it should be?
Well, so ultimately, that's a debate between the government, the people, and the Canadian Armed Forces themselves. And the Canadian Armed Forces think of themselves as a fighting organization. I think the people think of the Canadian Armed Forces primarily as a human security organization. And the government thinks of the Canadian Armed Forces, I think, primarily as an instrument of foreign policy rather than as an instrument of defense policy.
Or domestic economic development.
And each of that has implications for how you posture the force, how you equip the force, and the ability to deploy that force. And politicians want to do... Look, politicians, I think, are great masters of the art of the possible. They know that there's no votes or very few votes in a country like Canada in defense and security. And so how do you maximize the payoff that you get for the investment that you make? And I think politicians often ask, what is the return on investment that I'm getting from this organization, in particular in terms of the political objectives that the government of the day is trying to generate? The problem is, of course, the political objectives you generate for the investments you make today aren't for the government of the day. It is in many cases for the governments down the road. And so this is why we end up getting these very short-term perspectives on an organization that ultimately requires very long-term commitments.
I should get Ambassador Buck on that as well. Do you believe there's a consensus in the country as to what we actually want the Canadian forces to be or to do?
No, and I think part of that is because we haven't had the conversation about what our overall international policy should be. We haven't had an integrated international policy. By integrated, I mean foreign policy and defense for decades now, almost two decades. So I don't think there's a consensus, but I do think there's, as General Thibault said, there's a growing understanding from Canadians that the world is a scarier place and that we do need to do more. So you cited the Angus Reid poll. There was an earlier Abacus poll from about a year ago that said Canadians also want us to do more on foreign policy and defense. So I think Canadians understand, foreign policy and development. Canadians understand that the international level matters very much to us. So when Dr. Leuprecht said, it could be seen as a binary choice between do we focus on our Canadian forces on sovereignty at home or do we deploy internationally, I think that's a false binary. I don't think the kinds of threats we're facing right now can be parceled out that way. Most of the threats that are hitting Canada right now are things, so for instance, melting in our Arctic, increased competition in our Arctic. Where does that come from? That comes from melting sea ice. And the answer to it can be found by working more closely with our Arctic allies, all of whom except Russia and NATO right now, to do better military, not just Arctic warfighting, but sharing information, situational awareness, et cetera, that kind of thing. So the alliance and working with allies and those kinds of threats that hit us now, we need those allies. Another example, cyber. Or disinformation that rattles our democracies. Those are areas that are all discussed at NATO. We use NATO as both a political and a military forum to share lessons with allies about how you respond to those external threats. So Canada needs to work with those allies to respond to those threats. It's not just, focus on at home, try and protect by ourselves with a less reliable American partner, try and protect our own sovereign airspace, territory, and maritime, or work with allies. We have to work with allies to protect our own sovereignty. What the alliance also brings is a ready table of other allies where we can do a division of labor. Canada needs to think through in a more structured, strategic way what we're good at, what our forces are good at, what responds to our security interests most, and then work with allies to do that kind of division of labor. Because I personally don't think there's any world in which our Canadian armed forces can be large enough for us to be able to go at anywhere near alone to protect our sovereignty.
Christian.
Well, I always think of defense spending, and I think this is what the poll reinforces, as an insurance policy. And it's ultimately a question of what premium are we willing to pay for the environment in which we get, and what coverage are you prepared to buy, and what Canadians are telling us that they believe that we need more coverage and a higher premium precisely because of the complex developments that Ambassador Buck lays out. And if you look at the last 30 years, what the Canadian Armed Forces does today that the Canadian Armed Forces did not do even at the end of the Cold War, you can see that the expectations of the Canadian Armed Forces are ever expanding, and yet you're having to do this in an environment where you're overutilized and consistently undercapitalized.
Let's see if we can put a couple of solutions on the table here. And let's try this problem. We are understaffed right now in the Canadian Forces in a major way. General, how would you get more people to join?
Well, first of all, the good news is that there's a lot of interest in the Canadian Forces. In fact, this past year, 66,000 applications into the Canadian Forces.
How many did you accept?
4,000 is what this year's intake will be, and it's well below what it needs to be, especially when you put it in the context of, as I mentioned at the very beginning, the problem with keeping people with the organization.
Can you explain that, though? If we get 66,000 people who want in, and less than 1% are actually taken, why does somebody get rejected?
Well, so there's a number of challenges that the recruiting group, I think, is running into. But suffice to say that I think they're working diligently in sort of tackling all of those problems. Those are everything from the security clearances to the medical clearances to making sure that the folks that are actually applying will actually be able to succeed in the military. And there's a lot of interest, but it may not be the right fit. So there's many reasons for that. A low number, but certainly they're moving in directions where, in fact, the intake, I think, is going to meet the expectation. But It's going to take time. This isn't it's not a short time fix. And the problem after you've got people in is to train them. And this is where some of the challenges come in terms of some of the budgetary restrictions that are going on. We're protecting our capital programs for investments in the future, but we're squeezing the organization in its operations and its training and its maintenance. And that is material readiness. It's the training readiness of those people that we're bringing into the forces. So it's a wicked problem to try to solve. But we have to keep attracting people. The good news is that 30% of those applicants are women. 20% are visible minority. One third are permanent residents. So the problem isn't attracting people. I think there's a great value proposition for members for Canadians to see themselves in the Canadian Forces. And I think that's the good news. We got to work through the problems that are impeding us getting them into the system and trained.
And how do we do that?
Well, so there's two quick challenges. One is on the quantity side, that the interest is not distributed evenly across the country and among population groups. So, and ultimately, when you have an organization such as the Canadian Armed Forces, you want them to be representative of the society and the norms that ultimately, when the government deploys. The other is a quality challenge, that the Canadian Armed Forces, like so many other, is a high-tech organization. That is struggling to compete for the same high quality talent, but it doesn't have the agility that the private sector has to attract that particular talent. And we can see this in terms of many of the fantastic capital purchases that we are making and that the government is likely going to announce. We're going to have significant challenges to operate because we don't have the personnel today to operate it, let alone the personnel tomorrow.
I'm thinking usually when you want more people in, you double the pay, you make the pensions better. I mean, those kinds of things, I presume, are not going to work in this situation if the people who are applying are not qualified.
Well, and I think you start, first of all, I think the compensation and pay packages for the members of the Canadian Forces is actually pretty good. I don't think that when people are leaving, they're not leaving for issues of pay or compensation. I think they're leaving for issues of quality of life. They're facing the same challenges that a lot of Canadians are facing: housing, inflation. We've got a nomadic lifestyle in the military where you're asking families to uproot and move, going between one province, can't find a family doctor. So those are the things that are really, I think, causing members of the forces right now to look for other things to do. But the pay and compensation, I think, is quite attractive for Canadians to kind of look at the Canadian Forces. But they have to see that they're joining a team and an organization that's valued and is going somewhere. And that's why I do think that the government has to really tell Canadians where they're going with the armed forces and tell members of the forces themselves, this is where this institution is going. This is where you fit. This is the value. This is why this is so important. And I think that that's kind of missing right now.
We just have a couple of minutes left. And Kerry Buck, let me put this to you. And I asked the question, aware of the fact that much of the country was quite captivated over the last little while by the death of Brian Mulroney, because it kind of reminded, I think, a lot of people in the country that when he was the prime minister, we were kind of heavy hitters on the world stage. We punched above our weight and we were influential in the highest halls of power in this world. We're certainly not anymore, and I'm not taking a poke at the current prime minister. We haven't been in a while. So my question for you is, what advice would you give the current government in terms of one thing we could do to be more important on the world stage right now?
That's a big question. At NATO, to regain some of our political clout, we have to have a path to 2%. It's just needed in the political conversation right now. But the question you asked was much bigger than that. In the past, in my experience, Canada has made a name for itself internationally by being a generator of ideas. NATO was a Canadian idea at the beginning. Under Prime Minister Harper, it was maternal and child health. Under the previous Liberal government, it was the landmines treaty. And under the current government, there have been a couple, actually, but I'd say putting our troops back in Europe, in Latvia, the battle group is, for me anyway, it's a big deal. So we usually lead with ideas. And then when you build a table, allies come to that table because you've invested in those relationships over time. They're like insurance, so that allies will come to the table alongside a Canadian idea, like landmines, like maternal child health, like human security, and the list goes on. So I think regaining some of that policy confidence and those policy skills, and regaining the tools we need at the international level. And here I'm not just talking defense, I mean defense development diplomacy. Mm-hmm. We can't separate out and see the international as something optional, as we have for most of our history as a country. What happens internationally touches us directly. It touches Canadians' pocketbooks directly, their health directly, and their security directly. So not investing in international across the board is really shooting ourselves in the foot. The problem is we won't see it until it's too late. So I really do think, I made the plug for an integrated policy review, but I think more focus on international. Canadians are ready for it, and I think leadership is required to generate those international ideas and to leave room and take risk and generate Canadian policy ideas, Canadian initiatives that can honestly build the kind of world Canada needs in what is a very much more dangerous environment that we're living in right now.
That's Carrie Buck, former Canadian ambassador to NATO, now a senior fellow at the University of Ottawa. Thank you for being there for us, and we hope that your broken foot gets better soon so that we can see you in studio next time. Guy Thibault, the retired Lieutenant General of the Canadian Army, Christian Loyprecht, RMC, and Queen's University, thanks for making the trip to Toronto for us as well. We're really grateful.
Thank you, Stephen.
Pleasure.